For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KCI FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Heaven sends a song through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing. A new love affair, then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
Hello, and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org, and we podcast these days at, well, it's a long story, but let me just say that if you go to iTunes and look for public radio, or you go to my website, which is penonfire.com, and click on the radio tower, you'll be brought to the radio page with instructions on how to get to the podcasts, and we have about 100 up at this point. So lots and lots of shows for you to listen to. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today, we're very much going to talk about the business of writing and selling books. Two guests, Wendy Waris and Judy Culbertson. The first is Wendy Waris. Let me tell you about Wendy. She was born in Brooklyn in 1950, but has lived primarily in L.A. since childhood In 1970, she began working in the book business after being hired at the legendary Pickwick Bookshop in Hollywood. Following a stint at Rolling Stone, Straight Arrow Books in San Francisco, she began working as a publisher's sale representative and has been selling books ever since. She is also a professional photographer and for the last few years has worked as a freelance author escort in and around Los Angeles. Hi, Wendy.
Hello. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. Tell me about your book and how it came to be and when it came to be.
My book was the result of cleaning out my office closet 3.5 years ago one afternoon. I stumbled upon an essay I had written for my studies at Antioch University in the mid-'80s. It was a 25-page essay about my life in the book business up until that point. And I sat down, reread this thing, realized, hey, this is still good. And, hey, also, I think this is a book. At that point, I'd been in the business for 33 years, I believe, and just had a real epiphany that I've had a really interesting life and that people, all kinds of people who love books would probably like to hear my story.
Mm-hmm. So then what happened? What happened then? Did you start writing essays or did you do a book proposal or did you come up with the title? How did it progress?
I came up with the title right away, which is An Alphabetical Life, which is discussed in the first chapter of the book based on my experience at Pickwick Bookshop and running their children's department and insisting at the time on alphabetizing the books in the children's classics section by title, which was completely idiotic. And the owner of the store, Lou Epstein, rest his soul, my most beloved mentor in this business, kept coming up to the mezzanine, and this multimillionaire would take all the books off the shelf and re-alphabetize them by author. And then, of course, as soon as he turned his back, I would put them back on the shelf the same way. So the title came to me quickly. It took me about 3 years to write the book. No, I did not start it out as a series of essays or anything. I just sat down and worked with a wonderful editor who became my agent and determined what structure the book should take.
You have some wonderful stories in here about folks in the literary world. People no longer with us, like Richard Brautigan. I love that story.
Right, right. I had a rather bizarre experience with him. The year that I lived in San Francisco and was working for Rolling Stone, I met him one night at Enrico's Bar in North Beach.
Mm-hmm.
I was out with a group of people from Straight Arrow Books, where I worked, and Brautigan joined our group, and I ended up... having an experience with him.
Yeah, quite interesting.
Yes.
Will you read to us?
I'm sorry?
Will you read to us?
Read it to you.
Yeah, read from your book.
Okay, I'd be happy to.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, talking with Wendy Waris. Her book is An Alphabetical Life, published by Carolyn Groff.
Okay, what I'm about to read is preceded by a bit of information about my life at Rolling Stone, what it was like to be away from Los Angeles and from my parents for the first time. I was about 23 years old and worked under the wonderful tutelage of a man named Alan Rinsler, who was my first mentor in book publishing. He was the editor-in-chief at Straight Arrow. And then a few months into my year there, I went to Enrico's Bar in North Beach with some friends from the publisher, and Richard Brautigan sat down to join us, and I'll read you just a little bit of that.
Okay.
There was a charmingly seedy bar in North Beach called Enrico's, where my coworkers and I sometimes met for drinks after work. One night, a group of us gathered there at a round table on the patio that faced Carol Doda's strip club on Broadway, her neon torso with its theatrically huge breasts flashing on and off from the pink sign. I was enjoying myself, about to order my second drink, when I saw the shape of an extremely tall man from the corner of my eye. His height felt oppressive to me, and I turned around to look up at him. I realized that it was Richard Brautigan. He looked almost comically like a life-size cutout of himself from the cover of In Watermelon Sugar, his current best-selling book of poetry. Someone at our table knew him and waved him over. Brautigan sat down right next to me. Even though he was sitting down, Brautigan was so tall that I still had to look up at him to see his face, framed as it was by wire-rimmed glasses almost identical to mine. His shoulder-length hair was a washed-out shade of brown and more than a little unkempt, and perched atop his head was a floppy brown hat. He was wearing a sports coat that had seen better days and a pair of greasy Levi's that needed a good wash and were shredded where they reached the toes of his cowboy boots. He was also drunk. Instead of recoiling from him, I was enchanted. All through the 60s and 70s, Brautigan's poetry seemed to be standard reading among my friends, and it had touched and influenced my life. He ordered a vodka martini and, although I hadn't asked, another one for me. There was conversation going on around us, but because he had quietly slipped his arm around my shoulder, I instantly fell deaf and dumb. There I was with America's poet du jour. He was pressing his thigh against mine and matched my stark silence moment for moment. My friends from Straight Arrow kept up the appearance of casual cocktail banter, although it suddenly felt conspiratorial to me. Brautigan and I must have looked like a couple of morons, he with an empty grin on his face and me with wild eyes darting here and there, silently asking my friends, "Help me, what should I do now?" As my intuition failed me, Brautigan ordered another round of drinks for the table and made ours doubles. Finally, without ever having learned my name, he turned to me and asked where I lived. "Jones and Washington," I breathed, staring into his bloodshot eyes. It was then that I realized how unattractive he was, how nearly ugly his poor face was. Had the ruined features suddenly rearranged themselves into something approaching elegance, all the pain in his eyes would still have given the appearance of an unbearably distraught soul. He would, in fact, be dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the side of the head in a decade. And it goes on from there.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Wendy Waris read from An Alphabetical Life, Living It Up in the World of Books. I always talk about covers. I probably talk about covers more than I should, but I love the cover of your book. And I wonder, at what point did you know this was going to be the cover, and did you have any input?
I had an entirely different idea for the cover, which was not a very good one. and it seemed I had had a moment of complete, you know, mental illness while I was designing the cover in my head, forgetting everything I've ever learned about marketing and selling books. My publisher came up with this idea, which is a much more contemporary and modern than I had imagined. I cannot tell you how happy I am with it. At first, it rubbed me the wrong way. I thought, this looks like chick lit. But it doesn't.
It doesn't.
It really doesn't. And what I did ask them to add, and they did, was the stack of books upon which the woman is resting her feet. And that really made a big difference to my eye. And I just think it's lovely and elegant.
And the sepia tone is beautiful.
Beautiful.
Really, it's a wonderful cover. Curious how your experience in the book world and marketing books affected your becoming an author and then, you know, taking part in, well, writing the book, but then everything that comes after, you know, the promotion, the getting ready for the book, for the book launch and all that. How has it affected you?
Well, it was, I told Carolyn Graff when they signed me, I said, you know, I'm going to be a blessing and a curse to you because I'm not your typical author. I know exactly what you're doing, and I think I know how to do it best, but I promise you that I will try and stay out of it. I don't want to be an obnoxious author, many of whom, of course, I've worked with over the years. So I took the bull by the horns. Carolyn Graff, you know, did not have a large advertising budget for the book, and I did not have I wasn't able to hire an outside publicist. So I set up the book tour myself. I know where all the great independent bookstores are all over the country, and they were my priority because I support them with my whole heart. So I set up a very, I think, a wise itinerary, and was also able to, you know, create mailing lists. I knew who to contact. I knew I called in favors with people in the business, and I think it all worked. I've been on the bestseller list on the L.A. Times twice now, once about a month ago at number 10, and then more recently this Sunday at number 8.
I saw that. That is great.
Yes, and I'm just delighted and very grateful for all the good things that have happened around the publication of this book.
Yeah, I know. I can see where you would be a blessing and a curse, but probably more of a blessing because you understand the aspect of publicity and marketing and just what you as an author have to do.
Indeed, right. Yeah. And I think when all is said and done, Carolyn Graff was very grateful to me, as I was grateful to them, for everything that I did for An Alphabetical Life. And I did it in such a way that it was all very organized and non-hysterical.
Mm-hmm. Will you talk a little bit about being a book rep and what exactly book reps are called upon to do and the importance that they play in bringing books before booksellers and then the public?
Certainly. Publishers' book reps are the liaison between the publisher and the bookstore. We are not agents who are the liaison between publishers and authors. We work on two selling seasons a year, with our publishers, fall and spring. Each season, new catalogs with the new books are printed, new order forms, and they are distributed to all the reps all over the country. We go to sales conferences to hear editorial presentations of each new title and also marketing information. And then we come back home. We all have home offices. We set up our appointments with our accounts, and we go out there and sit down with the buyers in the back room and sell the new books.
Hmm. What's the best part about being a book rep?
The best part for me is the books. Books are in my blood. I think I was born with them in my blood because my father was a writer, a comedy writer.
Yes.
And being a rep has given me the opportunity to really, you know, have the chance to share my love and my commitment to good writing.
What's the worst part?
Oh, the driving, being on the road. As I've gotten older, my back isn't what it used to be, and it is becoming more difficult. And, of course, the traffic in Southern California, as you know, is horrendous. That's my least favorite part.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation, isn't it?
Right, yes.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Wendy Waris, author of An Alphabetical Life, published by Carol and Graff. You have so many insights and experiences with authors and the book business in your book. Was there anything that you had to leave out? And why?
No. There was nothing in about the authors that I know or have known that I had to leave out. where the editing really came in was in a couple of the chapters where I'd had bad experience with publishers, and Microsoft Press being one of them. There's a whole chapter in An Alphabetical Life about my experience, and it's really hilarious. But it turned out, after 15 years, to be a very negative experience, and that chapter had to be just trashed and rewritten because it was so nasty. And my editor wisely said, look, this doesn't work. It's the only part of the book where you seem like a different person. Mm. And I didn't want, I believe in karma, so I had to rewrite that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, interesting.
But for the most part, my life in books has just been wonderful. Filled with ideas and wonderful relationships. So much of this business, I think the most important part really is about relationships between reps and the bookstore and their book buyers or clerks who work in bookstores who help sell books, who will help hand sell books. Relationships between publishers and the reps, and of course relationships with authors, and I have really been blessed to have had just fabulous friendships and relationships and experiences.
Now, you just mentioned about hand selling books, and that's something that goes on in independent bookstores. In the larger chains, that's a difficult thing. I mean, it doesn't happen all that much, if at all.
That's right. I am not aware of any hand selling that goes on in the chains. I mean, it must happen. Certainly, there are some people who work in Barnes and Noble and Borders who are book people, but that hasn't really been my experience. The independent bookstores can make or break a book, much more than the chains can,
and much more than Amazon can too.
Much more what?
Than Amazon.
Oh, yeah.
Can.
Oh,
I mean, Amazon or online bookstores are wonderful at times, but they don't take the place.
Right. And when Carolyn Graf made the decision to publish my book as an original trade paperback, of course, that stung. My ego jumped in and said, wait a minute, I have to have a hardcover. It has to have a dust jacket, you know. But my editor convinced me that as a first book by an unknown writer, if the sales clerks get behind this book, and they have all over the country, when a customer comes up to the front desk with books to purchase, the clerk can just hand this person a copy of An Alphabetical Life and say, you know, I just read this and it's wonderful. It's only $15.95. Why not
right.
buy it?
Yeah.
So.
I agree. I love trade paperbacks. I think that in some ways, I mean, I love hardbacks too, but trade paperbacks are easy to transport. You can read them in bed without getting crushed.
That's
you know,
right.
Different reasons for them.
And I'll tell you, and again, you probably know this already, but the publishers are doing many more original trade paperbacks than ever before.
Yeah.
Particularly fiction, which was unheard of 10, 15 years ago. But it's working. It's a really good marketing decision.
It's working. It is, and it makes sense. Mm-hmm. Especially, as you say, if it's an author you haven't heard of and you don't know whether you want to take a chance on a book and put down, you know, $25 plus tax.
Right.
Or, you know, $15.
That's right. Yeah. And I know that decision has helped sell my book. So
now, real quick, because we have a couple of minutes left, I wanted to ask you. Earlier, you said you had just started writing your book. Now, did you finish the entire book before you sold it, or did you?
Oh no!
Take it and do a book proposal and submit that and da da.
I finished about 125, 140 pages. And a very detailed book proposal before my agent started sending it out to publishers, because it's not a novel. she felt that we didn't need a finished manuscript, and she was right. There was a good chunk of the book for the editor to read. That was, very indicative of my ability as a writer. So that was the case with me.
Mm.
And then I just continued writing while she was out shopping it around. And indeed, after it was signed, the book still wasn't finished.
Mm-hmm. That's the wonderful thing about nonfiction.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
You can sell it before it's done.
Mm-hmm. And my next book will also be nonfiction, a sequel to this memoir.
Oh, excellent. Yes. Does that have a date of publication date? Or?
Oh, haven't even started the book proposal.
Okay. We'll wait.
But I know what it's going to be.
We'll have something to look forward to.
Oh, thank you so much.
Wendy, we're at the end of our time, and I wonder if you have any advice for the writers who are listening.
Don't allow any thoughts of doubt to stay in your mind. I didn't when I was writing my book. Whenever they started to appear, I would just change my mind into a more positive idea, which was, this book is going to get published. Keep on going. You're talented. You can do it. And I had no doubt in my mind that A, I knew what I was doing, and B, that the book was going to get published. So that's my advice.
Excellent advice. Thank you so much for
Thank
coming
you,
on, Wendy.
It's been a real pleasure.
And continued best of luck with this book. It's doing so well right now. I imagine it's going to continue this way.
From your mouth to God.
Thank you.
It's been delightful.
That was Wendy Waris, author of An Alphabetical Life, published by Carol and Groff. When we come back, we will be talking with Judy Culbertson. So please stay tuned. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KUCI-FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I want to introduce somebody who has been in the studio now for a few weeks, actually a couple of months probably, because we haven't been here for a couple of weeks. So she's been silently in the background observing and training, actually, to become a public affairs host and guest host of this show. And her name is Marie Stone. Say hi, Marie.
Hello.
Hello. And she's going to also be on this next interview with Judy Culbertson, but you'll be getting to know Marie over the next few months. And she's a writer and former lawyer, recovering lawyer, and very nervous. So help her to be comfortable.
Thank you.
We're going to bring on our next guest, Judy Culbertson. Judy is a New York-based organizing expert who gives decluttering seminars coast to coast and is the author of the newsletter Traveling Light. And she's been published in so very many magazines and newspapers, New York Times. Oh, I don't have that list in front of me, or else we'd be here the rest of the half hour telling you what she's done. Instead, let's bring her on. Her book is called Scaling Down: Living Large in a Smaller Space, published by Rodale Press. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Great to have you on. Your book also won an award last year by the American Society of Journalists and Authors.
Right.
And I love this book because I have a problem with clutter. And I would like it anyway, because I love how it's written, and it's just such a, I don't know, it's just the right length. It looks good on the page. You can read it. You can skim it if you want to. There are cartoons. It's a wonderful book. Before we get into decluttering, talk a little bit about how the book came about.
Okay. Actually, the book is my ninth published book. I've been writing forever, but I wanted to get involved with, well, I needed a challenge about 12 years ago, and the two challenges I could think of were either public speaking or jumping out of an airplane, skydiving. And I knew that that would give me a heart attack. So I went for public speaking, and as a recovering messy person, I had always been interested in organizing and decluttering and why we're so attached to our things. And I started speaking on that subject. I chose that, and out of that grew my business of decluttering and helping other people, and eventually writing this book about it.
Interesting. Now, had you had a problem with clutter?
Oh.
I guess so.
Yes, I didn't know that I did. I thought that everybody lived by cleaning, by moving things from one room to another. That was the way I used to clean. And then we went to a vacation house, a rental at the beach with my extended family. And it was the most amazing thing. There were only, in the kitchen, there were only things you needed to cook with. And you just had to straighten up a little and you were done for the rest of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I decided that I needed that vacation house feeling permanently.
It's funny because just today, or maybe it was yesterday, I think I used that line to my husband because I said something like, oh, I hope we don't get lots of gifts, stuff for Christmas, because, you know, I want to have more of a vacation cottage. And he just kind of looked at me like, all right, yeah, okay.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. There's so much freedom when you don't have. I mean, it really is beneficial to be able to find things when you need them, where you don't have to spend 15 minutes looking for keys or glasses or the remote, things like that.
Why do we have such a problem with stuff? With, you know, it seems like the longer you live, the more stuff you have. And I remember when I was in school, and I everything I owned could fit in my car, and I was perfectly happy with that.
Yes. Exactly. Well, I think we spend the first 40 years of life accumulating, and then the next 40 trying to get rid of it and trying to get things under control. My feeling is that we're very attached to our things. We don't have a lot of time to straighten things up. It's a throwaway society, and that things are so easy and so cheap to pick up. And we just get inundated and then can't get out. When one reason for scaling down was for all the people who have been in the same house for 30 or 40 years and decide they want to move to a condo or independent living or back to the city or something else, and they just have all this stuff. They tell me, I'd like to move, but my stuff won't let me.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We are talking with, Marie is actually going to say something, but we're talking with Judy Culbertson, author, co-author of Scaling Down, Living Large in a Smaller Space.
You know, Judy, I'm curious about the logistics of putting together a book with another person. I know that you'd written several books with your husband.
Yeah.
And what's it like, logistically, what's it like to put a book together with somebody else, particularly somebody who's, I think, lives across the country from you? How does that work?
Yes, so she was a young teacher at the boarding school where I went, and we got reacquainted maybe 5 years ago and found that we were both very interested in organizing, and she was just moving to Denver and starting a business there. So when I had the idea for this book, because there seemed to be a dearth of books on just how to move somewhere smaller and yet keep the essence of who you are, mm-hmm. and the things you love. And in the case of Marge Decker and I went out to Denver. We talked straight for about a week. I took notes on my laptop. I asked her every kind of question that I could think of. And then basically, I came back to New York and wrote the book. It was kind of assumed that since I was the writer, that I would do the writing, and that's the way it worked out. That's what she was comfortable with. And
did the books with your husband go kind of the same way? Is he more of the photo end of the photojournalism, or?
Well, he's a photo, and we had in the permanent series of books, which were started with Permanent Parisians and went for 5 books and ended with Permanent Italians, and they're basically illustrated guidebooks to cemeteries in particular cities or states. And with them, we have short biographies. So he would take all the pictures, and I would do all the, you know, the short writing, the anecdotal, and then we would split the biographies in two.
Mm-hmm.
So if we had, say we had 60 in a book, we would each do 30. But maybe from living together, it got so that now when I look at the books, I can't always remember which of us wrote which of the biographies. So that worked out. In the end, after we'd done a couple of books, we had to make a list of everybody and then choose them because there were certain people that we both wanted, and obviously some people are more exciting than others, so we really had to make sure that it was fair. So we kept, you know, we alternated in picking the, like picking a team almost.
Now, I'm curious, Judy, about clutter and organizing in relation to writing. And writers have an awful lot of paper and stuff and research materials and files upon files, you know, that just get filled. And
yeah. How
do you then decide what to get rid of? With your taxes, they say, you know, you only need them for the last 7 years, so throw out everything else, or something like that.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But as a writer, what do you do?
Well, as far as writing, it's, yes, you can accumulate a lot of material. And you have to be strict, for instance, if you're writing a nonfiction book and you collect a lot of material, and then when you've finished writing it, you save anything that you've referred to that you would need in the future and just say goodbye to the rest. I remember having a conversation with another writer once, and she said something about, well, what do you do with all your drafts?
Yeah.
And I looked at her and I said, you mean you save your drafts? She looked at me and said, you mean you don't?
Uh-huh.
But the truth is that I don't save my drafts once I've made a revision, and once that's in a safe place, I don't hold on to them. Maybe you get to the point where you know that your biographer isn't going to need the material because you're not going to be having a biographer in the future.
Did that take some getting used to, though, being able to throw out drafts? And I mean, because, yeah, I'm thinking back, and I have drafts of my book. I have drafts of novels that haven't gotten published. I mean, I just have a lot of writerly stuff that I'd really love to toss.
Right. And I think that with drafts of novels that aren't published, I would hold on to, you know, at least hold on to them. When I'm writing, especially fiction, I have, you know, on my computer, I have, you know, kind of the bone pile. And when I cut something out, I save it over there just in case I might decide further on that was a good, you know, a good plot idea. So with that, but with something, once it's published, I think that you can get rid of everything leading up to it, or I do.
Mm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We are here today with Judy Culbertson, co-author of Scaling Down, Living Large in a Smaller Space.
I was wondering if you could give some of our readers who haven't had a chance to pick up the book yet just a kind of a little sneak peek, and maybe the top three or five or whatever appropriate tips you can think of where to begin.
Oh, certainly. I think one that I tell people in my workshops, and it's never very popular, is stay out of stores for a month.
Oh.
And that means eBay, the shopping channel, craft fairs, yard sales, and you'll save money. You won't see the wonderful new things that have been invented, and you won't see the things that are on sale at such a remarkable discount that you feel that you have to buy them because you'll never see them, you know, so inexpensively again. So if you can, you know, stay out of stores, or at least cut down on it for a little while, that's certainly one. Another is that you really have to make sure that everything has a final resting place. I know that sounds ominous, but it just means that everything needs a place that you put it back to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when things have a defined place, it really is not unpleasant putting them away. It's, you know, kind of like doing a jigsaw puzzle. But if you're just putting things down temporarily, I'll just put it here for now, then, you know, it's going to stay there, and it's going to attract other papers and other things. So certainly returning things. And I think that, you know, kind of pre-cycle. When, in other words, when you go to workshops or concerts or church or anything else, take the program or the material and put it on a chair on your way out. Don't even bring it home, because that's going to, it'll just kick around and you won't know what to do with it there. They say that 90% of what you bring home from conferences and workshops never gets looked at again.
Yeah. Except you think you will.
Yes, you do. You do. And
what if you do? What if you need it?
Yes, right. That's well, I think that if you realize that things are coming at us at such a fast pace that even if you've saved last month's magazine, you're going to get this month's magazine, newspapers, everything else is going to be more current and more compelling, so that things that you're making a pile of to read are going to stay in the pile because there's just too much.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because I've had a problem getting rid of magazines and newspapers to the point of, at one point, I had, I think, a two-foot-high stack of L.A. Times and Wall Street Journals that I still hadn't gone through.
Right.
And now, if it's sitting on the stool for more than a couple of days, I'll just put them outside. And
right.
I mean, the newspapers. And then the magazines, I've found, because I hate to throw things out, and especially, you know, landfills, filling them up. There's an organization called freecycle.org.
Oh, yeah.
It's all over the country, and it's a place to post things you're giving away, and things like old magazines, things like mailing envelopes, and just the oddest things that you couldn't really ever sell even, but
right.
You can give them away and feel good that somebody else is using them.
Yeah, I know that, you know, 10 years worth of gourmet magazine, people will jump at.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that way you feel that you're not just giving them, you know, adding to the landfill or whatever. So, yeah.
I haven't found anybody who wants my tub of National Geographics, though. And I don't know what to do with those.
Are unfortunate. People sometimes ask me, hopefully, about their old National Geographics, and I have to break the news that they're worth nothing. They're worth less than nothing because everybody saved them because they were so beautiful. And there was just a glut of them. I know some library sales will specifically say no old encyclopedias or National Geographics.
Right.
So
right.
It's sad.
What about gifts that people give you that, you know, aren't necessarily returnable? And what do you do? Is it better to just donate them? Do you re-gift them? What do you do with those?
Well, I think that if it's something that is handmade, that somebody made for you or crafted for you, it's important to take a photo of them with the gift when they give it to you. And for some reason, that takes the sting out of it when they no longer see it around your home. And especially if you have a copy of the photo of that lovely Afghan that your great aunt knit for you, then you can give it to a homeless shelter or somewhere else and not feel guilty about it.
Yeah.
But I think that, yes, thank people for things, but don't feel that you have to hold on to them. I mean, the person really is not in the gift. And you also, you know, maybe you have the Afghan, we're given the Afghan because your great aunt loves to knit or crochet. And you were just a warm body who was there. So, you know, it's not always, the gifts aren't always as meaningful as we sometimes feel about. A lot of times people will keep them and not display them anymore, keep them in a closet and feel that they can't give them away. But you really can. You really have to keep your life current, because if you know the principles of feng shui at all, you really have to keep things that are in your current life and not hold on to the things from the past that don't mean anything anymore.
Yeah, it's such a, I think the more sentimental you are, the harder it is to get rid of things.
Mm.
And then you find yourself renting a storage space, which
yes.
I've always said, if it gets to that point, you know, put me away or put me in the storage space.
Right, because exactly. I've known people who have actually added on to their homes.
For storage.
For their stuff, yes.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, in some ways the storage unit is mild by comparison, but really it's not necessary.
I would guess that all of your past travel experiences probably put a pretty fine point on this. You know, if you're having to lug around stuff to Europe
yes,
and back
right.
again, you really find out what's necessary and what isn't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when my husband and I travel, we really, even when several years ago when I went to Russia for 3 weeks, I just took a carry-on suitcase.
Wow.
And we always just take carry-on luggage, one for each of us, when we travel, even to Europe or the summer to Ireland. And, you know, you find that you don't wear that, you know, that many. It doesn't matter if you wear the same thing every 2 or 3 days.
Do you come home with just a carry-on?
Well, the carry-on has a zipper because we're very, you know, we're bad about buying books. So usually, and, you know, we pick up a few things, gift things or clothing for people or children. So with the zipper compartment, it helps. But
that's my problem. When I'm traveling, I think, I'm never going to be here again. I have to buy everything I see.
Everything.
I know. And you think that what you bring home is will somehow be imbued with the feelings of the place.
Yes.
And
exactly.
You get home, you know, even if you pick up a beautiful rock and you get it home and, well, it's a rock.
Exactly.
Oh, well, your book has been having some effect on me, because today I was driving down the highway and saw a little sign for an estate sale. And it being Thursday and an estate sale, it means that it was the first day and nobody knows about it. And I really felt it pulling me. It was pulling me, but I didn't stop. And I just kept going because I thought, I don't need any more stuff. I really don't need stuff that I love from an estate sale, because I love old stuff.
Right.
And I could just buy more of it.
Yeah, I defy anybody to spend a morning going to estate and yard sales and not finding something they have to have, and usually more than one thing. I mean, you know, I don't go to them myself for that reason, because I'm not immune to... You see things that remind you of your childhood. You see things so reasonable. I mean, it's just too much of a temptation.
Judy, we're at the end of our time. I wonder if you could offer any words of wisdom to the listeners out there who may be writers and are dealing with clutter.
Okay. Well, basically, keep your stuff confined to one area. In other words, don't let the papers migrate all over the house or all over the room. If you can at least keep what you're working on confined to one place, then you only have one place to go to look for it. Even though there's a pile of stuff on your desk, at least if that's the only place where you're keeping what you're working on, you know it's there.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Oh, I've enjoyed this.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay.
That was Judy Culbertson. Her book is Scaling Down, Living Large in a Smaller Space, published by Rodale Press. And I neglected to say how much I like the cover, but I do. And so there's that. If you'd like to know more about the show, and thank you, Marie, by the way, for helping out.
Thank you. This was fun.
If you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can visit penonfire.com and email me from there if you want to be on the weekly email list. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Samuel Johnson, who said, "The two most engaging powers of an author are to make new things familiar and familiar things new." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett and
Marie Stone.
See you next time.